Hello there, good afternoon. Knives, makeshift weapons and bolt cutters, just some of the items Kent police say they've found
Kent
near the so-called
Camp for Climate
Change.
Kent police say they've drafted in 700 officers and have £1 million budget with which they're determined to stop activists closing down King's
Stand
North
off,
Power
police
Station.
Police and protesters watch and wait, getting ready for a massive march against a replacement
police
power station.
Police in riot gear have used batons and pepper spray on campaigners who are gathering outside King's North
Six
Power Station.
Six arrested as riot police clash with protesters at the King's North Climate Camp.
This is Rise Up Radio, Nottingham.
Hi, I'm Elsa and you're listening to Rise Up Radio.
Rise Up Radio.
RiseUpRadio.wordpress.com.
This is Rise Up Radio. This is Rise Up Radio.
My name is Ginger. That's Ginger.
Hi, I'm Hillary.
Hi, I'm Nigel.
Hi, I'm Nico.
Hi, I'm Dom.
Hello, I'm Charlie.
Hi, and I'm Genevieve, and you're listening to the September edition of Rise Up Radio.
Rise Up Radio. Rise Up Radio.
Hi, I'm Jack, and today on the Rise Up Radio show, we've got coming up an interview with an expert on raw foods and what a raw foods diet can do for you. And we've also got coverage of a free food giveaway that happened in Nottingham City in August. Then we're going to talk about the Camp for Climate Action and what went on there. That happened at the beginning of August, and we'll reflect upon that and talk to people from our area about their experiences at the climate camp. We're going to have music from Spam Chop and Dr. Coca-Cola McDonald's, all local artists. We'll hear about some forthcoming debates that will be held at the Sumac Centre, also entertainments that are going to be happening there in September and beyond. We're going to get an update on anti-fascist activity in the East Midlands, and I think that's about it. But first of all, we're going to hear a track from Alberto Vito, and it's called Let's Buy Everything.
that's nothing compared to the waking dreams in my mind. Nor the life that I've seen for us both behind your eyes. And it's clear to me there's more romance in broken things. You fail to see there's more romance in broken things. Yeah, let's buy everything we desire. Pile it all up, start a fire. Invite our friends, call everyone. Conspire against those free thought freedoms. Let's buy everything we desire. Pile it all up, start a fire. Invite our friends, call everyone. Conspire against those free thought freedoms.
Well, that was Jolly. I'm sitting here on the sofa with Charlie, and we're going to talk about raw food and shakes and Jack's arm. There are two lovely looking shakes on the table here. Could you sort of tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, well, they're actually a couple of juices I made up before the show. One of them's a carrot juice for one particularly afflicted member of the audience here today, Jack, who appears to be sporting a broken arm. So this is, I think, as a result of some of the police brutality at climate camp. His case is certainly not an isolated one.
Could any of these shakes be used to heal the police force and stop the brutality?
Well, yes. In fact, it's very good that you should say that. Basically, the British police force is suffering from some seriously bad cases of potty training. They have immense behavioural problems. They are quick to anger, and it reminds me of some words of Gandhi when he was asked what he thought about Western civilization, and he said he thought that would be a good idea. And I very much suspect that he would still give that response today. As you can tell, I'm not a great fan. I did witness this brutality myself when I visited the Camp for Climate Action, and this shouldn't be happening in the 21st century, and they would benefit. I understand a lot of police officers actually spend quite a bit of time down the gym due to their role in society. Now, if they were to adopt a raw power lifestyle, and that's a take for any athlete that's taking on about 3,700 calories a day, which I will talk about in a moment, something miraculous would happen with them. At the moment, they're basically toxic. They're eating cooked foods. I saw a lot of them, what they were eating, and their diets are appalling. And this, I'm absolutely convinced, and I've spoken to psychiatrists and psychologists about this as well. I'm absolutely convinced that their behaviour is adversely influenced by the diet that they have. Also, they get pretty terrible orders from their superiors.
Well, we have Gandhi in the police force using these delicious drinks. What about the listener? How could they sort of make their own versions of these, and what would the benefits for them be?
Well, the benefits are enormous. I mean, they're certainly superb for healing. All kinds of healing. I've made another one here, which is a carrot and cucumber juice for Ginger, who's suffering from pyorrhea, some gum infection. And you can actually heal it. And you'd find out after about 2 to 3 days of drinking probably about 3 pints. So it's quite a lot. But you'd feel invigorated.
Yes, how many carrots is that? Ginger just asked.
Well, you're talking quite a lot, to be honest. But you know, when you're in a bit of a healing crisis, and personally, I don't touch modern pharmaceutical medicine because of the side effects that it has on you, and many of them are quite unreported. I prefer. I'm a natural hygienist, which basically means I prefer to do my healing through my diet. And it has to be said that the father of modern medicine said, "Let food be thy medicine, and thy medicine be thy food." And the father of Chinese medicine also said something along those lines as well. So ancient wisdom, they knew full well that you could heal most ailments in the body through having raw natural food.
But these drinks are also useful for those of us not suffering from pyre or broken arms.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we really ought to start incorporating these kind of juices into our everyday diets. Now, I'm not suggesting that you have to drink 3 pints a day, but it would do you an awful lot of good because you get rapid absorption of all the nutrients within about 15 to 20 minutes from the moment of drinking. Whereas if you just eat a carrot or you eat a cucumber, it takes considerably longer. And on a stressed system, what you want to be introducing is something that can be rapidly assimilated by the body, and these juices do the trick.
Well, they certainly taste a lot better than they look, and I encourage everybody else to start drinking them. Okay, and we're going to go over to a report by Kiney, who did a talking to people who were doing a free food giveaway outside McDonald's earlier this week.
I'm in Nottingham, outside McDonald's, and something seems to be happening here. What's going on?
Free food for everybody, free vegan food, global leaflets, and a lot of cake.
And are people enjoying this?
Yeah, of course.
Everyone's going mad for it. Pretty much by the end of the day, Nottingham's going to be vegan.
So what are you giving out here? What is all this stuff?
It's a variety of vegan food that people usually think vegans can't eat. So we've got chocolate cake, some carrot cake, some vegan cheese from the lovely Bute Island chaps, biscuits, burgers, tabbouleh, pasties, samosas. It is literally a feast.
It looks amazing, actually. It all looks really good.
Educating and showing is an alternative to what they're currently eating, you know, an ethical, more environmentally friendly, that whole nine, you know, alternative.
Environmentally friendly?
Yeah, of course. Basically, the vegan diet, causes a lot less of a carbon footprint than the meat industry because, you know, obviously they have to grow food to feed the animals with and have... And, you know, grow food for ourselves and, you know, the amount of water they use to graze beef and everything, all that. It's,
But how are you managing to give it away for free? Do people...
It's been donated to us. So it's people within the group have baked it themselves or by certain companies or certain restaurants nearby have donated to it, you know, that are aware of the message and want to give it out themselves, you know, want to help us out with getting this message out.
So what about the location? What's that about? Why are you here? Anywhere and not somewhere else.
Well, it's really coincidental that we was actually walk around the What's Wrong with McDonald's leaflets, and we happened to be outside of McDonald's.
Complete coincidence, I see.
Complete coincidence, obviously, because you know we're nice people, honest. But you know, I mean, you know, a lot of people go by here for the buses and all that, and obviously, you know, there's a lot of food shops down here, you know, that. So it's just showing that there's an alternative about, you know, in Nottingham. There is alternatives in Nottingham to what, you know, you do get in the main part of town.
Right, well, that was the free food giveaway, of which there will be plenty more, I gather. Okay, we're going to move on now and start to reflect on and talk a little bit about the Camp for Climate Action 2008. That was held down in Kent near King's North. First off, we're going to hear from a couple of guys who got involved in the Eastside neighbourhood this year. And here's a bit of audio from them talking just before they travelled down.
So we're in Nottingham, it's Saturday morning. We're at the Sumac Centre and there's loads of people leaving for the climate camp. Why are you going down to the camp?
I'm going down to the camp mainly because it's a perfect opportunity to obviously express my disgust over the current economic system and how it's ravaging the planet and creating all sorts of social injustices as well as going down there to empower myself, learn a lot of things, meet some nice people, network with some nice people. Network's a horrible word, but you know what I'm talking about, meeting nice people, and just having a time in a nice place away from all of the madness so that I can have a good think about what's going on in the world. And
ever been before?
No. Very excited.
You've heard good things about it?
Yeah, lots of good things about it. So I've been paying a bit of attention to the global justice movement over the last few years and that, and paying attention to what happened at Drax and Heathrow, and it sounds like a very, 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 very important and positive thing.
Have you been before?
No, not yet. No.
What made you choose to go?
Because my friends were going, because I think it's an important issue. And because I'm quite interested in the going to the neighbourhoods and just being part of that, and also being able to rest my mind away from the city, and to be able to feel what it's like to live in a democratic society, at least for a little bit.
Right, so those guys were on their way to the climate camp. Now fast forwarding a bit, it's now post climate camp, and we're joined by a couple of chaps who were doing stuff at the camp, involved in the East Side, but also the Climate Camp Power Collective. I'm with Nico here. Hi Nico.
Hello, Jack. How's it going?
I'm pretty good, thanks, with my one arm and my raw food juices. And Ginger over there. You're right, Ginger.
Yeah, very good. Better for that raw juice as well. My pyrrhea, that is. My
pyrrhea, not diarrhea.
Not diarrhea, my poorly gums, not poorly ass.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about kitchens and turbines and things. Can you guys hang on while we hear a track from Dr. Coca-Cola McDonald's?
Definitely.
Yeah. That was Edinburgh. I was going to do a little spinning wheel and do like an old song so people can hear that. So I might do an old song for some people. This is a song that I did before. It's called When You Generalize.
Generalize.
Huh? You see that? When you generalize, they're general lies. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh fucking, what am I doing now? It's Bossa Nova, I think. Yeah, let's do that. When you generalize, they're general lies. I had a friend called Mr. Patel, I used to stay in his hotel. But one day I started to worry, cause he was Indian but he didn't like curry. What? An Indian person that doesn't like curry? That can't be true. Could it? Cause when you generalize, a generalize. And it means you got nothing to say, cause when you generalize, they're generalized. And it means you got nothing to say. I had a friend and his name was Ray. A nice guy, he was gay. But he didn't like disco with his pizzazz. He only liked heavy metal and jazz. What? What? A gay man that's not always thinking about casual sex, high-energy dance music, and is really, 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 and I mean really, really, really rubbish at interior design? Has the world gone mad? Because when you generalise, they're generalised. And it means you've got nothing to say, cause when you generalize, they're generalized. And it means you've got nothing to say. I had a friend and his name was Dale. He was straight, white and male. But he didn't know anything at all about a sport called football. What? A straight white man that's not constantly thinking about lager, football, and had the ability to multitask? What would the newspaper say? Because when you generalise, the generalise, and it means you've got nothing to say. Thank you very much.
That was Generalize by Dr. Coca-Cola McDonald's, and I'm here with Nico, who's going to talk a bit about the power at Climate Camp this year. So, Nico, what were you doing sort of day to day at the camp to make all the laptops run and mobile phones charge up and stuff like that?
Well, the thing is, Tin, once we'd set up all the equipment, I mean, once we'd set up the solar panels and the wind turbines, they sort of generated their own electricity. So, I mean, it was more just a case of checking that all the batteries had enough energy. And if there was excess energy, then we could, like, charge people's mobile phones and we could turn the sound systems in the evening up a bit louder so everyone could dance a bit more. Just making sure that it was all running smoothly. I mean, the initial setup was a bit more challenging. We had to put up the turbines. I think we had almost 4 or 5 turbines on site. And then the main sort of solar panel arrays, was one truck there that powered quite a lot of the sort of the main tents. And then all of the media area were a separate network.
And did you set up a sort of an equivalent of the national grid, or was everything sort of running on batteries and wheelbarrows like it was in previous times?
We had a bit of both, actually. We sort of ran all of the different neighbourhoods off their own individual batteries, and then they could then bring their own equipment, like their own solar panels or wind turbines, and then top up the battery. I sort of had a little parallel between that and like an anarchist type society, whereas each area is responsible for its own requirements, but then if it has excess energy, we can then move batteries around and charge up other people's batteries. But for the main sort of services tents, the media tents, the like kitchens and things like that, they were all running off. There were two grids, one powered by V3 Power's wind turbine and the Generator X van, and the second one was Indy Media's, which had a whole network of solar panels and wind turbines.
Stuff. And there were a couple of diesel generators quite near the site, but not quite on the site, at both of the main gates. Well, I think there were probably actually 3 or 4 in total there. So someone said a statistic about them using up more power than the whole site for some lights. Is it sort of, is it a ballpark figure? Is that a right sort of estimate to make?
Yeah, it's really scary, actually. You don't realise, but they get these big higher-in, they're big diesel generators with sort of 4 spotlights on each generator. And I have a feeling, like, each spotlight uses around about 1 kilowatt or more. So that's 4 kilowatts. That's, I think, at peak power, the camp was using 1 kilowatt. So each one of those towers is about 4 times the camp's total supply. And they had, about 3 or 4 of those towers, I think you're right. So that's 16 times the camp supply, and they were on for at least 12 hours a day. So they were using a huge amount of energy just to blind us effectively and cause everyone to trip over. That's the police for you.
That's all very interesting, and now I think we're gonna hear from Jack, who's talking to Ginger about another type of power use on site, the cooking aspect of the climate camp this year.
Yeah, that's right. How's it going, Ginger?
Very well, thank you.
And so what were you doing at the climate camp? Were you involved in the power, providing power, or some different kind?
I did help for maybe 30 minutes, helping. I was holding the end of a rope while the turbine went up. But yeah, I came in and helped with the kitchen. The people, veggies, came and set up the kitchen for East Side, and then had to go to the Northern Green Gathering, and there was a shortfall. People were needed to coordinate the cooking and make sure there were enough washers up, and make sure there were enough servers, and make sure that the people of East Side and anyone else that chose to eat with us got 3 square meals a day, and that it was tasty and interesting as well. So I kind of got involved with that.
So it wasn't something that you actually took on prior to the camp, but just something that kind of happened. Now, could you just tell us a little bit about the kind of energy that the kitchens run on, or your specific kitchen ran on?
Well, it ran on fossil fuels. ran on butane, propane, gas, I think.
But some help from the renewables on site also with providing sounds for the kitchen collective, is that right?
Yeah, it was very important to have a good energy in the kitchen. We had lots of volunteers helping us all day and chopping and washing vegetables, and tried to make sure we had a good reggae vibe on in the kitchen, and people dancing and keeping it cheerful in there. So it was a bit of communication with the power boys, making sure that we had regular batteries topped up so we could go back and forwards between them and make sure that we had enough music so we could turn it up in the evenings, or at least have enough music on all day for people to be enjoying themselves.
What's your view about how the camp went in general? What do you think about it in terms of successes and failures?
I mean, for me, I didn't really leave the camp during the main days. I stayed in the kitchen. I felt that, you know, being a cog in the machine of it, making sure that when people came back from their actions, they were well fed and nourished, I saw that as just an important role. For example, making sure there were sandwiches for people to take out. We made some, like a bean pate, a kind of rich and nutritious pate for sandwiches for people to take out when they were leaving the camp, to make sure that they were well fed if they were staying out overnight or if they were going to have a long day on a march or a protest.
Do you think it worked, this experiment in sort of sustainable and living in horizontal organisation?
Yeah, there were definitely moments where I thought of the climate camp as a bubble ending at the perimeter and ignoring the police trying to make our lives very difficult and, you know, blinding us with their stupid kilowatt lights and actually thinking about living like this and using composting toilets and cooking in field kitchens, cooking communally, cooking for 100 to 150 people at a time. So, you know, it maybe takes, you know, 5 to 10 people to cook the meal over a few hours in a nice relaxed way, rather than 3 people having a breakdown doing it and sharing the workout, but making sure that there was enough food for everyone and making sure that, you know, I found it a really efficient way of making sure that everyone got what they needed. And, you know, I think there were lots of other people doing similar roles, taking on a responsibility for something that needed doing and making sure that it kept flowing, that the machine of the camp kept working. I think it's a really positive example of ways to live. And I mean, God, if we could have a camp like that, you know, a site like that on a more permanent basis, it's a beautiful way to live. I really enjoyed it, particularly the Poo River view, which was very close to our kitchen, and that was the nearest place you could go and sit on the compost loo looking out over the power station and just reflect on the fact that we weren't using the power station that's already in existence. We were living off grid and we were able to survive quite well and, you know, have a really good time there without looking out across the estuary at the smog coming out from the existing power station.
Well, yeah, I've heard loads of excellent comments and compliments that have gone to the East Side chefs and their helpers that were at the climate camp. So yeah, big ups to the kitchen crew.
Yeah, I think part of that is that it wasn't our job, it's not our normal job, the people that did that. Most of the other kitchens were more professional field kitchens, the Anarchist Teapot cooking really good food, and Central Kitchen doing huge portions, and for them it's something more like an everyday work, whereas I think for us, because we chose to come in and it was at a late stage and we just wanted to make ourselves useful, I think we brought a different energy to it because we just wanted to be successful. We've cooked for people's kitchens before, maybe 40, 50 people, but cooking for 100 to 150 was a different thing, and to try and make it exciting and varied every day, I think we tried very hard because it wasn't our normal job. It was just trying to get through it and trying to make sure it worked. You know, we got stroppy and everything, but it was important that other people brought things. They didn't just chop. They would say, oh, I think, you know, things taste better like this, or you should use these spices, or we need more of this, and made sure everyone was tasting it with clean spoons every time, of course, but make sure that people were tasting and had an involvement, active involvement in the dishes they were preparing. They weren't just skivvies. They were, their opinion counted and it mattered, and it made all the difference, I think, as well.
Okay, Ginger. All right. Well, thanks a lot for talking about the kitchen experience today, and also Nico for letting us know about how things worked with the power side of things. So if people want to know more, also you can look at v3power.org. You're listening to Rise Up Radio September show. Our website is riseupradio.wordpress.com. There were quite a few students at this year's climate camp, and particularly we noted staying in the East Side neighbourhood. And earlier on, I caught up with Tom, and it was his first visit to a camp of this sort.
The first thing that really greets you, or the first obstacle, is what came to be known as the Israeli checkpoint, where the police were rifling through everyone's gear. So that was like your first impression, I guess, which wasn't a great one. But once you get into the actual camp, it was totally different and really fantastic. I was quite impressed at how well organised the site is and how everything's laid out, and you've got this whole infrastructure that appears in such a short space of time. So it was quite amazing to arrive there. Yep.
And what did you get involved in when you arrived?
I looked through for a number of workshops. I mean, there's so much going on throughout the week. You can never possibly do everything that takes your interest. I got involved in quite a few workshops and helping out in the neighbourhood as well.
Could you just say a little bit about what happens in a neighbourhood at the Climate Camp, or just to tell us what a neighbourhood is and what happens within a neighbourhood?
Sure, yeah. So the camp is divided into neighbourhoods depending on region. So I was in the east side barrio, as it's called, which was kind of including Nottingham. And so you'd have a meeting every morning to discuss anything, any issues arising, a consensus-based meeting, and that would feed into the overall site meeting. So that's the kind of basic structure for the social organisation of the camp. Which was really impressive. It's kind of a participative form of democracy, and it was quite inspiring to see that work with hundreds and hundreds of people. And also, all the cooking would be done centrally in your neighbourhood. So we had three meals a day prepared in the East Side Barrier, and hats off to the East Side chefs because it was really good.
Brilliant. So it's a pretty sort of comprehensive experience of communal living, condensed down into a sort of about a 1 week period, and there have been three climate camps over a period of 3 years. Where can you see this movement, if you can call it that, going from here on?
There was talk at the end of this camp about some sort of rolling blockade if the government give Eon the go ahead to build Kings North. I mean, that's a distinct possibility. My personal sort of feeling, or, I was gauging from the feeling at the camp that a lot of people would be keen to have another camp, but whether a blockade in the camp will happen, I suppose that remains to be seen, really.
Okay, and in terms of the future for yourself, what do you think you'll be doing in the near future?
Definitely intend to keep my ear to the ground about what's going on with the climate camp and where that goes next. And I'd like to definitely get involved as and when I can. I think as well it'd be great to raise the profile of these kind of projects and other environmental endeavours amongst the student population. So that's something that I'm definitely going to look into.
All right, Tom, well, thanks a lot for joining us today, and I wish you all the best.
Okay, great. Thank you.
That was Tom with his reflections on this year's Climate Camp, and now for a bit more local music from a producer called Spam Chop. This is Teen Wolfgang.
funky. Okay, in a moment we're going to talk a little bit about some debates that are going to be happening in Nottingham over the autumn months. First off, though, let's hear from Jacob, who went to the climate camp also. I asked Jacob from where he came and what he thought of the climate camp.
I'm from Essex, Colchester, and I go to university in Nottingham.
I see, and you went to the climate camp this year?
Yeah, I was in Eastside, with a few people from Suffolk and that sort of area, but yeah, mostly Nottingham crew in Eastside.
So, could you just tell us a little bit about the reasons why you went along, what you thought you might get from it? What did you expect?
Partly to meet other people who shared some of the same views as me. But mostly, I was most interested in the sort of running of the camp and the day-to-day workings of the infrastructure and the way the camp's run.
What kind of skills did he take to the camp, and what did he do when you were there, and did that match up to the skills, or did he get involved in doing new things and learning new skills?
I went with sort of limited experience of sort of practical things, but yeah, interested in learning a bit about it. I had a bit of a go at helping out building some of the compost toilets, which is enjoyable. But mostly I spent time working on the security of the camp, which I didn't originally intend to do, but I arrived on the Monday, which is when the camp had problems with incursions by the police, and I ended up working with the security working groups, and working with the police a lot, sort of face to face.
The challenges that are posed by the repression that was faced by people on the site. Do you think that it's worth trying to create spaces like this openly that that suffer oppression? Is it worth trying to defend them, or should our energies be directed into doing other activities?
I think to create a space like that temporarily, it was, as you said, a massive drain of energy. Even when the sort of oppression, as you called it, was merely psychological, like flying helicopters over in the middle of the night, or lining up riot cops and then letting them get back in their vans at sort of 5 a.m. I think it's still worth it because the experience that you get living in a space that's so totally different from ordinary life for a lot of people, it gives you a perspective of the possibility of alternative ways of living, not just environmentally but socially as well.
Okay, wicked. So just before we go, are there any particular highlights that you'd like to retell from your stay at the climate camp?
I saw some pretty uplifting films, especially the one on the Shell campaign in Ireland. Was really incredible to see sort of spontaneous direct action from local people who had no experience, and really being able to see, after being at climate camp, the potential for support from people with more experience and how that could be a really have a real impact on small local campaigns like that.
Cool. All right then. And you'll be going back to Nottingham to continue your studies then in September?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay. Well, best luck with that, Jacob, and thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thanks very much.
Right. This is the voice of the local youth here. We're talking about Jacques and his masturbate. Are you going to have a masturbate, Jacques?
Yes, that's right, local youth. Yes. Some of us who were at the climate camp went along to some workshops held by various people, including some from the North West and Scotland. Now, these guys organised a series of 3 workshops at the camp to talk about social change, posing the question of, do we want social change or do we want climate change, or to stop climate change? I.e., where should the focus of the movement be? Should it be to stop climate change at whatever cost, or should we be looking at the root causes of climate and energy issues and global injustice, which may or may not be, well, probably is capitalism. So, it was an interesting experience for me learning and just discussing this and wondering, what we're doing as a climate movement. Do we want austere state measures for carbon rationing? If that's the only way to do it, or do we really want a free society and the freedom to organise ourselves and to not discriminate and to not screw up the planet at whatever cost? We're just wanting to ask some questions, really, both of the climate movement and to just stimulate discussion about social movements. We're going to set up and host a series of three debates, which will be at the Sumac Centre in Forest Fields. The first one will be on Tuesday, 23rd of September. The overarching sort of theme of that first debate will be state. We're going to look at solutions to the problem of climate change that involve the enforcement of measures to prevent climate change that involve having a state, so that solutions are imposed from the top down.
Richard Branson's going to sort us all out, isn't he?
Well, one of the questions that we'll be asking, can capitalism solve climate change? And if so, at what cost? We'll look at the joys and promises of the world of green capitalism. We're going to take a serious look at some of the proposed methods of sort of radically reforming the current way that the global system of capitalism is organised, particularly with reference to economics, the degrowth movement that's coming out of France, which is de croissance in French. So that's the state. We will also be looking critically at the role of the state, how the state intervenes.
And then you're going to talk about anarchy next, the week after, isn't it? Which is like jumping up and down and punks and that, isn't it?
Well, youth of the street, we're actually going to address a number of questions. But the reason that second debate is entitled anarchy is because we're generally looking at solutions that don't require government, so how people just do it themselves, and the possibilities there.
Is that because no one votes anymore anyway?
Well, exactly. No one votes. Why is that?
Because they're all wankers.
So we're gonna focus in on the current politics within the climate movement. What do we want? We're gonna cast our view far and wide and look at movements of resistance around the world. We're gonna talk about the dangers of fascism and how we confront the state and global institutions. That's anarchy on the 21st of October at the Sumac.
And then it goes to November, and you're going to talk about our towns transitioning, toy towns, yeah?
Yes, youth on the street. We're going to be talking about solutions that kind of get away from all the conflicts and potential scary stuff that's happening, but concentrate on building a beautiful future in various green, sustainable towns.
This little rabbit here, the permaculture, urban agriculture. That sounds...
Yeah, that's like about sort of digging up the verges and things and how we could maybe grow food around our neighbourhood.
Guerrilla style.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Rad.
Land-based living, land-based cooperatives and communities we'll look at in the third of the debates, and addressing food production and consumption. So it's kind of like... the positive way forward, looking at self-sufficiency and what we can do. But that's building alternatives on Tuesday, the 18th of November, at the Sumac. The debates will be recorded, and I think we just want to see a lot of people there and just lots of ideas and passion and excitement, so that we can kind of get excited about where to go from here after three climate camps. Is there the energy to do more climate camps? But otherwise, what should we do? I know perhaps Hillary might have some ideas about that. But
that's Rise Up Radio present the Sumac Mass Debate.
So look at veggies.org events to remind yourselves about these. Each of the debates will start at 7:30. The doors will open at 7. They'll be free. So I'm going to just pass this mic over now to Hillary, who's sitting on my right.
Thank you very much, Jack.
So Hillary, could you just tell us a little bit about the background to a campaign that you've been involved in recent months?
We're just about to talk about the open cast coal mine protest site in Shipley. So I'd tell you a little bit about it. It was it's a planned open cast coal mine, which is in its early stages at the moment. When the site was set up about a couple of months ago, it was work had barely begun, and there was like just the start of it as we arrived, pretty much. It's an open cast coal mine run by UK Coal. It's a 122 hectare site. That's from memory, so that might be wrong. The planning application for the site was originally rejected by Derbyshire County Council, but that was overturned by central government. So a minister decided that it was so important, and I've been told that this was related to some of the planning application changes, legislation that changed planning application processes over the last couple of years. So there was a lot of local opposition. Basically all the councils were against it anyway. As an organisation set itself up called Leave It In The Ground, which was pretty self-explanatory. It consisted of a website, and then they organised a mass trespass as well, and then a little bit more about the background to that as well. Climate Camp process has obviously been focusing on no new coal recently, saying that coal is obviously a really dirty form of carbon dioxide, of energy that produces lots of carbon dioxide. And Climate Camp has focused on Drax and King Knut's North. So in 3 years there's been two coal-fired power stations. So there's a background in general about protesting about coal, and lots of the other other environmental organisations, campaigning groups like Greenpeace, and for example, have had a similar focus as well. So there was a lot of background anti-coal mine stuff that allowed this to be possible. And so it was the combination of that sort of local opposition to the fact that a big open cast coal mine will be on their back doorstep, and the more national global movement about climate change came together. And I do believe this is sort of really the first protest site in relation to climate change. And so I'll explain a little bit what I mean about that in terms of the tactic of protest sites. Okay. So the tactic of protest sites is a semi-permanent squatted camp, which is usually either directly on the land that will be used for a particular development, or nearby, providing a platform for direct action at the development, or to use the euphemistic term, development. The history of this, probably, I'd say this is my history. Other people might disagree with it, but I would say you can chart it back to Newbury in the 90s and the road protest movement at the time. So in Newbury, a lot of people were just climbing up trees and then getting pulled out of the tree, and then the tree would get cut down, and then they would move on along the route of the Newbury bypass. Now none of the battles of the road protest movement, if I'm my memory says me well, were actually won, but the sort of the war was in that the road protest movement upped the price of building roads so significantly that the new road movement was stopped. And on the back of the road protest movement, a series of other protest sites have been set up around the country at various times using this tactic of just getting physically in the way of work, and using sort of squatting rights and similar stuff to make getting them out of the way a bit more expensive. So to talk about a few of these, there's Nine Ladies, which is one of the most successful protest sites in the country, which is in Derbyshire, where a huge number of protesters were involved in establishing a protest camp at the Nine Ladies Stone Circle, protecting it from being used as a quarry. And that is one of the protest sites that has never been evicted, because the bailiffs, the company that were going to mine the place, quarry the place, found it was too expensive to even consider. And then a few other protest sites are Ticknor Woods, Bilston Glen, both of which haven't been evicted. Ticknor Woods is in Brighton and protesting against a housing development, and also Tesco development. The two developments were linked together in applications. And Bilston Glen was protesting against a road that would have gone to some kind of biotech company headquarters. So protesting against the road, but then also the biotech as well. Neither of them have been evicted, but then a few others have. Brecon, for example, was evicted, I think, last year, and that was protesting against the building of a gas pipeline by the National Grid. So there's load of different protest sites. And that was sort of the background was the tactic of protest sites being used on an open cast coal mine in Derbyshire. That's sort of what led to Shipley Bodge. And Shipley is near Heena is Shipley Country Park, and then the small town of Smalley, and the 122 hectare site is between Smalley and Shipley Country Park on the road running through it called Bell Lane in the middle of Derbyshire. So if you want to go and disrupt the coal mine, then
you should.
You should, yeah, and you should go there, basically. So, because why the hell not?
Cool. So, did you want to say anything about the kind of tactics that were employed whilst the occupation was going on? I mean,
well, the main thing about a protest site is the sort of the being there, because health and safety laws, like, a very important part of the process, stop like much work going on if you're around. There's also the threat that if you're there, you might go and stop them working by either in the middle of the night secretly committing acts of pixieing, or otherwise just sort of getting in the way of the diggers. So pixieing refers to because pixieing is never done by actual humans or protesters, but rather by pixies that don't really exist, go around and sort of maybe involved in stuff that has been often accused of being criminal damage. But that's obviously ridiculous, because pixies aren't governed by UK law, so they can't commit criminal damage as such. So theirs is more just a whimsical act of sabotage in line with Mother Earth's general intentions. So pixieing, I think that's probably pretty self-explanatory. But then other things like accountably stopping work involves like jumping on diggers and stuff like that. So being on the site not only stops the working directly there, because they're not allowed to run over you under UK law, bizarrely, and but it also gives you the opportunity to go and do these other things, because you're right on site, so you're in the middle of them, and it costs them loads of money and security and all those kind of stuff. So generally a relatively sensible strategy. Now, to remove you from a site, they've got to evict you using the civil court process, because you're living on site. So they've got to evict you from your home. They have to prove that the land is theirs. So they have to go to court. And one of the main ways of stopping the eviction taking place is to go into court and provide a defence. Now, obviously, it should be really relatively open and shut. It's not your land, it's theirs and stuff. But if you have a relatively good grasp of the squatting law, definitely useful in this is seeking advice from the Advisory Service for Squatters in London, which is www.squatter.org.uk, or just ASS, looked up on a non-Google search engine, then they'll be able to give you legal advice about how to defend yourself against a possession order in court, which can in Shipley extended our stay there for at least a couple of weeks. Moving into the squat, living on the squat, and then the main key to avoiding eviction is by building defences, which make it hard for the bailiffs to get you off the site. So talk a bit about defences. Had spent a long time there. I've got very excited, so I've got a lot of things to say. There's a few different types of defences. The one that I really enjoy the most is like actual physically barricading, like the squat. And we were lucky in Shipley to have an old abandoned building which we were able to completely barricade up, making it all like relatively impenetrable to all but the best tooled up of the state's henchmen.
Is that right, that the ex-residents of this property were quite behind it as well? They'd been kicked out quite abruptly, and I heard they were quite keen that people should defend their house, and have been their house for quite a long time.
That's definitely the case, yeah. The family that had previously lived there were very upset at being moved out of the property to make way for the coal mine, and they brought us water and things like that. Water was very important because we were off grid, and so we had to rely on water being brought in. They brought us water, and they came around and they hung around. They brought their huge dogs, incredible dogs they had, massive dogs, and just hung around on site, which was really, really good fun. They were just one element of the huge amount of local support, because nobody wanted this coal mine. The defences themselves, like involved barricading the building, which was, as I say, really really satisfying, particularly satisfying, because opposed to most of the other defences rely on the fact that the bailiffs that are coming to evict you have to obey health and safety laws when they're trying to drag you out. So the other types of defences are aerial defences, which is basically being up in the air. That's either nets hung between like trees or between buildings. Walkways, which is just a rope going from one structure to another, which you stand in the middle of, and they can't cut you down. Bizarrely, under UK law, they're not allowed to murder you. Or just generally tree houses, or just being up a tree. And in those cases, police officers, for example, tend not to be able to climb above 6 foot, according to health and safety law. So if you get off the ground, then they would have to bring in specialist police officers to arrest you. In the case of eviction, it's not, you're not under threat of you are under threat of arrest, but it's actually usually bailiffs that come and get you first, they try and remove you, and they need specialist bailiffs to climb up the trees, and they use a team of climbing bailiffs, I believe from Sheffield, which have been shunned by the climbing community, I do believe. I don't know a great deal about that because I'm not a member of the climbing community, but apparently it's a big political issue within the climbing community. So people capable of dragging you off on the ground are very unusually capable of climbing trees. So aerial defence is one type of defence. Lock-ons is another defence, which is very similar to the lock-on tubes used in blockading, only less portable. So sometimes people will drop a concrete block in front of the gates of Faslane and all put their arms inside tubes. Well, if you have the luxury of being on the place that you want to be locked onto for 6 weeks in advance, you can make the concrete block very big and locking yourself into the middle of the such concrete block. But the real key and the real story of Shipley was the success of tunnels. So we were only on site for about 6-7 weeks perhaps, but in that process we were able to dig a tunnel that took the national eviction team 6 or 7 days, I think 7 or 8 days in fact, to dig out and remove the people. Now that will have cost them an absolute fortune. So a little bit more about that health and safety thing. We were lucky enough at Shipley to be evicted by the National Eviction Team, which is a private company, who are very health and safety orientated, and careful about PR and stuff like that. This is opposed to, say, for example, another organisation which is involved in eviction last year at Radley Lakes, and that organisation is called Sheer Force. And as you can imagine, their approach is slightly different, and they were massively violent. For example, one of the things that you need in a tunnel is an air supply. You install your own air supply, which is just a tube, and you have like a computer fan on the end of the plumbing tube or something like that, blowing air constantly into the tunnel. When they appeared at Radley Lake, Sheer Force just tore that air supply straight out, as opposed to National Eviction Team, who will install their own much better air supply. And it's all a little bit funny. Obviously, National Eviction Team make more money the longer you stay there, so they've taken that kind of approach, where Sheer Force have just used brutal violence. Sheer Force company, I believe, is linked to the same security firm, or one particular individual director of the same security firm is at Edo MBM in Brighton. What I wanted to really say there is that that this kind of site-based protest is a really good tactic. And to illustrate this, I'd like to draw attention to the cost of policing, say, for example, Climate Camp, which was going on at the same time, was in the millions. Now, it might have been in the, like, sort of, I don't know, 7-8 million, something like that. Well, and there were lots of people at Climate Camp, like 1,500, 2,000, however many. Yet the eviction at Shipley, although we don't know for sure exactly how much was spent at Shipley, we know from previous evictions that a 7-8 day eviction will cost them millions as well. Whereas that's 10-15 people at Shipley versus 1,500 people at Climate Camp. And it's just about upping the ante, really, is the difference that I'd like to sort of point out. And the key thing is that who pays for it? And whilst we pay through our taxes, which we all pay, don't we, to the central government, we pay to be policed at Climate Camp. It's UK Coal themselves that paid for the eviction at Shipley and all the inherent costs. So they'll have had to foot that bill. So it's all about like health and safety and all those kind of things. But like the particular thing that I really enjoyed was like actually physically barricading. It took them a good day to actually get into the building once it had been barricaded up. So that's an ordinary brick house, and they came with all of the equipment, and it still took them a day to get through our 4 or 5 foot barricades, 5 foot deep barricades, wall to floor to ceiling. Very exciting. I think people should go and visit all the existing protest sites if they want to have a look around and see how it's done. So that's Titnall Woods in Brighton area, Bilston Glen up near Edinburgh. Nine Ladies in Derbyshire is actually in the process of being taken down, but is full of the best defences in the country for sure. And then as well as those kind of sites with the defences in them where you're in the way of work, there's other protest camps like Rossport Solidarity Camp, for example, which I'm not quite sure whether Rossport is squatted or not, but it's a similar direct action camp with a similar ethos, but just not necessarily physically on the land. But then also, an important part of the movement that brings about these kind of things is just squatting in general, and the squats going on in many cities. I think there's a new social centre opening up in Cambridge. Every couple of months there's a new one in London, and Nottingham's had them in the past, not as many as some other cities and stuff, but I think it's really important to go around, go visit squats and all those kinds of things, and begin to spread the idea that we can take a more direct and physical approach to these things and get huge success if we do. So if you're interested in the coal related stuff, please visit Leave It in the Ground or Climate Camp in general, the Coal Hole. I had a really amazing time. Like, the real positive thing for me about the whole thing was just being in a place where we were digging and we were building pretty much non-stop. You could wake up and grab a spade and physically stick it to the man, like, out in the field, just there and then. But it's not really a negative as such, but it's just like an opportunity for improvement. It's like, just more people would have been amazing. Like, if more people had come to the site and we dug bigger and deeper tunnels and like more tree houses and stuff, would have cost them more money. And it was strange to see the huge amount of effort that went into climate camp, which is really, really positive. And just the fact that if even like two or three people had come to Shipley, we would have cost tens and hundreds of thousands of pounds more. So that's a very good point. The embarrassing thing about the link with climate camp is, of course, we were evicted during climate camp, and a heck of a lot of us weren't there. We were in Kent, which is very embarrassing. It's shoddy work, but we went where the fun was and paid the price. It's been done before. Like, often sites get evicted during Glastonbury festival or in the aftermath, when lots of people involved in sort of traveling lifestyles are doing the litter pick. And this year we were evicted during climate camp, which is very embarrassing because it's kind of obvious, really. Can I just add one last complicated issue? Is one of the big things at Climate Camp for me this year was seeing Arthur Scargill come. I didn't listen to him talk, but I read his newspaper that he was handing out. And the difficulty that Climate Camp has to face in acknowledging that for many years, the mining movement was at the forefront of class struggle activism in this country. And I think that is a really, really important thing. They are the leading exponents of industrial warfare, or industrial struggle. But the really interesting thing is that open cast coal mining, it doesn't provide jobs for miners at all. It's a very low intensity employing industry, and I would suggest a good compromise for the climate change movement would be to say no open cast and no foreign coal. And if there was no open casting and no foreign coal, that would dramatically reduce the amount of coal in our country. And I just think the convergence of different things on open casting is a very strong thing. I don't know whether that kind of compromise in rhetoric is ever really likely from the climate change movement, but I think it's my suggestion for a good way forward. Ramble, ramble, ramble.
Thank you so much for that. It was very interesting. I'm now sitting here with Nigel, who's going to talk a little bit about the Red, White and Blue Festival and the protest against it that happened over in Derbyshire, and also just talk us through some of the sort of political shenanigans that are going on within the fascist party and the childish squabbles.
For people who don't know, I guess that's probably... it's been mentioned a few of the the Rise Up radio shows that have gone before. But I mean, the Red, White and Blue Festival, such as it is the national rally event, call it what you will, of the British National Party. It's held, obviously, every year. It's moved around in the past. It's been held in Lancashire and Wales. This year and last year it was held in a place called Denby in Derbyshire. Last year there was one person protesting against it. This year there were a number of protests and events in response to it on the part of local anti-fascists.
And how did the protests go this year? And so much success?
Well, I mean, in terms of, clearly if there was one person last year and there were several hundred people this year, it's obviously quite a major step up. I mean, the festival still went ahead, obviously, although I think they had a much harder time. In the run-up to it this year, they put in an application for a premises licence, which is what allows you to play music and sell alcohol. Initially, the police had said that they were quite happy for that to go through. At the 11th hour, when the hearing was taking place, the police changed their position, imposed a number of conditions, in direction, I think it was a 7-foot-high fence and security lighting, which the BNP would never have been able to afford. So what happened at that point was when the panel went away to consider its view, when they came back, the BNP simply withdrew its application. Then they later on tried to put a temporary events notice in, which is a kind of a reduced application. It allows them to play, I think it's music and drink within a marquee, so it's a limited number of people. They didn't get that either, again, because the police were concerned about the risk of a mobilisation against the event. So this year they didn't get the licence. They weren't legally allowed to sell alcohol. They weren't legally allowed to play live music. I mean, the conditions, so they held it as a private party, which is a slightly different series of rules. Now, that's something they've never had before. They've never had that problem. So in that sense, it was clearly a success in that sense. There were several hundred people. The protest itself took place on a place called the Bungalow, which is on Codner Denby Lane. At one end it's Denby, at one end it's Codner. There was a protest rally and a march in Codner with several hundred people, a number of people from trade unions, Bob Crowe from the RMT, organised locally by Nottinghamshire Stop the BNP, with Unite Against Fascism nationally, people from Searchlight and various other organisations. One thing that was interesting about Red, White and Blue was in a way that it looked to some extent like a consolidation of a party that's had a lot of problems over the last year, perhaps no longer than the last year, I guess. Locally, the main representative of the BNP recently was Sadie Graham, who is a councillor for Brinsley, who was the BNP's group development officer and some other quite high-ranking position. In December last year, she was thrown out of the party. She was accused, along with Kenny Smith, of maintaining a quote-unquote treasonous blog, which had been critical of Mark Collett. Now, Mark Collett was the head of the BNP's, the youth BNP, Nick Griffin stood trial recently, he stood trial alongside Mark Collett. Mark Collett's often viewed by a lot of people as the heir apparent in the party, so he's very much Nick Griffin's his favoured mini-me, but he's just... Most of the BNP hate him. He's an idiot. He appeared on White, Young Nazi and Proud. He was also on a show with Russell Brand. He didn't come out of it very well. A lot of the party would quite like to get rid of him. He's very unpopular anyway. So Sadie Graham and Kenny Smith were accused of criticising him. In actual fact, it looks actually what was going on was a kind of power struggle within the party about who was going to take positions of power. Now, they tried to consolidate themselves. Those people who split, when they split, they were followed by a number of other people. In January this year, they held a conference in Brinsley. I mean, that was, by all accounts, hugely policed out, police fans. And a Freedom of Information request subsequently put in suggested that it cost the police something like £12,000 in manpower alone to police this thing. That was supposed to be the point where the movement, which had called itself initially the Real BNP, later the Voice of Change, it would go on to call itself the Independent Nationalists and the Democratic Nationalists. But at that point, it was called the Voice of Change. It had its founding conference, kind of said, well, we're not going to openly criticise the BNP, but we're kind of going to go along and try and change from within and all this sort of stuff. And of course, it died on its arse. So what we've had subsequently is a lot of those people who'd moved around in that milieu moving back into the party. I mean, it's worth pointing out, if you look at the history of fascists in this country, they tend to kind of go whichever way the wind is blowing. When Mosley was, it looked like he might be moderately successful, they were in the BUF. Then they moved into the NF. When that all went a bit tits up, they've all moved into the BNP. They'll go wherever they think that, you know, wherever the think they're most likely to have some success. They're not greatly principled as people. A lot of them have drifted back to the BNP. Now, one of those is Nina Brown, who I'd and other people had always taken to be a Sadie Graham supporter. She was the person who amusingly allowed the BNP security department into Sadie Graham's house. There's a very humorous account she's written, not humorous, deliberately, where she let them into the house and didn't realise they were nicking stuff. She just thought they were taking the computer out because there was, you know, for some reason it didn't occur to her they might be nicking it. It was all very strange. She's now rejoined the party and is now the organiser in Broxtowe, which was Sadie Graham's area. Now, that's what's interesting about that is that the BNP are now making quite a lot out of the fact that the BNP group is going, the Broxtowe group is going quite successfully. They held a meeting with Nick Griffin on the 9th of August. I don't know where that was, somewhere in Brinsley, which is a little worrying because we thought the party was frankly screwed in Brinsley, and it clearly isn't. They're clearly getting themselves organised again. They've had some successes just over the county border in Derbyshire in the elections this year. They won a seat in Heanor East and Heanor West. It was Chris Roper and Lewis Alice Brooke were elected as councillors. And in the Heanor and Losco ward, now there are three wards in Heanor. The third one is Heanor and Losco. I think it was 512 votes to 513. They came within one vote of, well, I guess it's two votes of winning, but they came within one vote of the party who won. Now that should be that's pretty worrying. I mean, Heanor is within Amber Valley, which is the area that the Red, White and Blue Festival took place in this year and the year before. So they're having some successes in this region. Now, of course, one of the big worries coming up next year is that, I think I'm right saying, it's in the European elections. Now, there is a very good chance, not necessarily in this region, but somewhere in the country, that the BNP will come out of it with at least one MEP. It's a proportional representation system. Nobody votes, of course. Nobody gives a fuck about European elections, but there is a very real chance. I mean, possibly north of here, I would have thought. I think I heard a rumour that Griffin would stand in northwest. But yeah, that's a potential risk. They are clearly getting themselves organised. Not to say that it's all going entirely brilliantly. I mean, they had to be bailed out of Red, White and Blue. Was funded basically by either one or two, quotes unquote, Scottish idiots in Nick Griffin's terms. That basically people gave about £5,000 to pay for it because they haven't got enough money. They're financially screwed. But in electoral terms, we're looking at a situation right now where the far right is probably as successful as it has been at any time since the late 1970s. Now, at the moment, that hasn't translated into a huge amount of violence on the streets, which obviously for a lot of people is the real concern, the kind of physical threat of fascism. But they're actually building themselves and they're getting that base and getting organised and translating that into positions of influence in councils, parish councils, borough councils, and perhaps even higher up in fairly soon. And there is a risk that as they become more successful, they'll become more confident, and that may well translate into people, you know, how it wasn't that long ago that you'd have fascists attacking political meetings and randomly sort of targeting people in the streets. And it's not happening at the moment, but we need to be aware that as they become more successful, we could see the return of that. And the best thing to do is to stop them before they get to that position where they're capable of doing that, when they are fairly weak.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Nigel, for all of that. All right. And I think we've got some Dr. Coca-Cola next, is that right?
That's right, yeah. We're going to have another tune from Dr. Coca-Cola now. After that, we'll be talking to the Sumac Entertainment's group about what we can expect from our local social centre in the upcoming few months. I'd like to apologise to listeners for any pop and crackle they might hear in the background at the minute. There's some rice crackers in the studio which are causing a bit of distortion. But this is Last Christmas by Dr. Coca-Cola McDonald's.
Back in the 1980s, there were two men. One of them was a nasty boat. There was two men. One of them was a lantern-jawed god. He was bronzed, he was intelligent, he held loads of degrees, he was clever, he was kind to the poor and children. He was a wonderful man that everybody respected. His name...
Who was that, Tony Blair?
No, it wasn't. Fuck off.
The heart.
No, I didn't mean that. I think you love it. Let's meet after the show.
Right, okay.
He was a beautiful man. man. His name was Andrew Ridgely. And he was a god. Oh, yeah. You give it up for Andrew Ridgely. He was sex on legs. The other man was a filthy, dirty troll. And the children were scared and threw stones at him. And he was grotesque. He was covered in boils. And his name was George Michael. So I'd like to present a tribute to those two polar opposites. Thank you very much. My last song. Thank you.
Now Hiya. Can you hear it? Now you can hear it. All right, this is the voice of the local youth, and we're here talking to you. It's Eva talking about entertainment at the Sumac Centre, which is that Christy place in Forest Fields. Right? Is that right?
Hiya. Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. So what's going to happen? It's not just going to be an empty space full of dogs and kids this month, is it?
No, it's not. There's going to be lots of things on. We put together a new entertainment collective, which means that hopefully we're going to try and make sure that there's lots of things happening at the Sumac throughout the coming months. This month's just the first month, so there is a few gaps, but it's quite exciting. We've got Heckle Those Cocks, which is a fundraiser, an awareness raiser for the Shutdown H&K campaign, a Bury Weather campaign, and it's called Heckle Those Cocks. It's going to be a karaoke
that
night.
Before. That's Heckle Those Cocks karaoke at the Sumac to heckle those heckling cocks.
Yeah, and that's on Friday the 19th. So I would definitely recommend everybody gets there, because what we're going to do is we're going to sing as loud as we can. For the Shutdown H&K campaign, we're going to record it, and then we're just going to take it down on a mobile sound system and play it straight back at them.
Maybe on
the whole recording, the whole thing, straight back at H&K, down on Lenton Lane. Anytime anyone wants to go shut them down, it's always a good idea. They're on Lenton Lane in Lenton Industrial Estate, Unit 3. But that, you know, that's beside the by. But that's Friday the 19th. I think also on that weekend we've got a band playing called the Red Shoes. Also, I think on Thursday the 18th, we're doing a new thing. We're going to be doing storytelling. which is, I think is quite exciting. Basically, just bring a book with a story in it, or a story that you've written, and people will just reading out loud, basically, to each other and sharing stories and things that we like. And that's going to be, so if you fancy, you know, just a drink on a Thursday, come and listen, bring a story and read it.
That's on Thursday the 18th, is that?
Yeah, that's Thursday the 18th. And then what's very exciting, also coming up this month, we're trying to vary the things, you know, because this thing makes it like a versatile space, and we're trying to put on as many different things as possible. Also in the hope that if anybody else has got anything that they want to put on, they will put it on as well. If you want to be part of the entertainment collective, then just talk to somebody there, and we'll be happy to have you on board, because we need as many people as possible to make the Sumac really good. But the 23rd, mustn't forget that it's the Sumac debates at 7:30 on Tuesday.
That's
the 23rd.
Debate, yeah.
That's good. With two brunches coming up as well. The Sunday brunch at the Sumac is back. It's going to be a regular thing. It's going to be the second and the fourth Sunday of every month. It's going to be the Sumac brunch.
Full vegan fry up, yeah.
Well, we're not having it. It's a full vegan brunch. Ooh. And it's up to whoever's cooking the brunch to decide what the brunch is going to be. So it's a bit of a, it's also a bit of a surprise. You go, you don't know. I mean, the last one that we did was a toast your own brunch, and there was a variety of different homemade breads, and you could just help yourself and toast it yourself. Obviously, along with a variety of other tasty vegan goodies. But we're gonna vary it, so it adds to the element of surprise on a Sunday. Oh, I fancy some food. Let's go check out what they're serving up at the Sumac brunch.
I suppose we're gonna have a world regional premiere of Ready Steady Skip at some point. Is that right?
At some point, that is coming up. I'm not sure. Don't think that's coming up in September. I believe that's coming up in October. That's very exciting. We're just waiting for the final edit on Ready Steady Skip, okay. And then we think we're gonna incorporate it. Maybe we're gonna try and do a whole event, maybe around food and raising awareness of food.
So maybe some kind of Skipped People's Kitchen or something like that.
Yeah, Skipped People's Kitchen. Maybe bringing in like the home. You know, obviously it's harvest time. Maybe we'll bring in like some home veg. But you know, don't hold me to any of this. It's all yet to be. All yet to be arranged. If anybody else wants to take it on and arrange it, that would be amazing. That's because that's how Sumac works as well. Is if you want to do it, come and do it, and we'll help you out.
Wicked.
Oh, and Scroat's back.
Say
I was
again.
So many things.
Scroat's coming back. That's what is that? Simple cinema run on alternative themes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I'm glad that you remember what it stood for, because I wasn't sure. But that's back on Wednesday the 24th. The film is yet to be decided, but I think it's going to be really nice. It's going to be kind of bring it back as a regular film night at the Sumac, showing well good films full of things that we should see and know about.
Brilliant. So Eva, some new energy coming into the Sumac, some new some rekindled old ideas and some new ideas here, and lots of new entertainments.
Yeah, and just any information, check out the Veggies Diary. Veggies are really good at keeping it all up to date. So if you want to know what's on, also just come down to the Sumac and have a look, because hopefully we're going to start having things on so regularly that every time you come, there's going to be something on. But again, don't hold me to that, but that's the aim, really, is to make the Sumac somewhere that is really worth stopping in, because you never know what you're going to find.
And some people say it's a bit of a clique at the Sumac, but I think they're right. Basically, if you want to come and get involved, then you're in the clique. And if you want to come and expect things to happen, then you're not really in the clique. So come along and make things happen.
Well, I think maybe like people worry about it being a clique. But if you turn up and are enthusiastic, that's good. But we're hoping that through the Entertainment Collective, also there will be more things happening. So there'll be more things to get involved in, so that we can help people. We can just make it more open, appear more open and more friendly. It is really friendly, but I can, because everybody knows each other, that can be more difficult. So the more things that we have on, the more people we bring in, the better it's going to be for everybody. And that involves everybody coming along. I want it to be a space where people, if they're looking for something, they can come and they can find it. And they can also make it happen for themselves.
Word.
Empowering people. I think it should be good.
Definitely.
Respect. All right, cool. Well, okay. I hope the rest of the show goes well. And
thanks,
yeah, thanks a lot. Okay, right. Speak to you next month with more exciting stuff happening at the Sumac.
Ciao for
now. And there'll be all the more exciting stuff if people come to us with exciting stuff.
Back to Jack.
Bye.
Well, that's fantastic. That kind of wraps things up, really. That's about all. It's been a mammoth and epic show with loads of talking, but it's all really interesting stuff. And so hopefully people have taken the time to to check it out. We've got one more track to play to finish with. Just before we stick that on, Dom's just going to remind us about his show that's coming up.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you to come to the website, download it in 2 weeks' time. I've been talking to people from Milwaukee who are involved in anti-war movements, pro-immigrant groups, and, of course, listening to lots of the good music that's coming out of Milwaukee. It's going to be hopefully interesting, and I quite like talking, so please tune in.
Okay, yeah, we've got to give a big call out to our sound man tonight. He's been the most professional in the house. It's the Tin Man pressing the buttons, clicking the mouse, moving the buttons around, making the lights go beep. That's him there. And this is Dr. Coca-Cola.
I hope this song is used on a commercial. I hope this song is used on an advert. I hope this song is on a commercial. I hope this song is used by Primark. I hope they put everybody in the dark. And a tree its wood is made of bark. And a sky that is called Earth's glass. Oh, I'm not doing that again. That was rubbish. The last time I used child labour to write a song. What can you expect from a Bangladeshi 4-year-old? Topical. Song is used on an advert. I hope the song is used on a commercial. I hope the song is used on an advert. I hope the song is used on a commercial. I hope the song is used by Tesco. I hope the song is used by Tesco. Because I have a picnic out in the park and old Fresco. Oh, that's Lily Allen. Sorry, I think that was cool. I hope this song is used on an advert. I hope this song is used on a commercial. I hope this song is used on an advert. I hope this song is used on a commercial. I hope this song is used by Bill Gates. You know the richest man, the guy called Bill Gates. I hope it's used to sell by Windows. I hope this song gets used by Windows. End now or cancel. 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 And now cancel. And now cancel. Come on, and now cancel.
And cancel.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to hear. Thank you.
Rise Up Radio at indymedia.org. Rise Up Radio.